I would ask the clerk to call the case.
322-0247, in re marriage of Thomas Velas, appellee, and Elena Velas, appellant by David Winters.
It's my understanding, Mr. Winters, I'm going to ask you to come up and start your argument. But before I do that, Mr. Velas, it's my understanding that you were not going to be arguing.
No.
That's correct.
Correct.
Thank you. Please step forward, Mr. Winters.
May it please the court. I am John David Winters of Winters Family Law, LLP. I represent the appellant respondent, Elena Lyons, in her appeal of the trial court's February 14 order and the subsequent May 27 denial by the trial court of Ms. Lyons' motion for reconsideration. Ms. Lyons and the appellee petitioner, Thomas Velas, were married in 2010. They had two children. A girl, now 12 years of age, I think, and she is in seventh grade, and a boy, now 8 years of age, and he is currently, I think, in the third grade. By all accounts, the minor children are doing fine, and there are no, as I understand it, currently pending disputes between the parties other than this pending appeal on this vaccination issue. The parties divorced in 2018, and the parties' allocation judgment was entered by the trial court in December of 2017. The parties agreed, and the trial court found and ordered that both parties, Ms. Lyons and Mr. Velas, were fit parents, and that both parents would jointly make decisions for the minor children on all issues, including health decisions. This matters before the court because the parties could not agree regarding whether their minor children would receive school-required vaccinations going forward. Mr. Velas wanted the children to receive, quote, presently required school vaccinations, and Ms. Lyons objected on religious grounds. In 2021, Mr. Velas asked the trial court to modify the allocation judgment, essentially for, quote, current situations, so that he be given, I think, sole decision-making authority on the issue of school-required vaccinations. There were other issues in dispute at the time. The parties went to mediation. They were able to resolve every issue except the vaccination issue. There was a hearing on the vaccination issue on February 14, 2021. Mr. Velas presented three witnesses, the parties here, and a GAL, Mr. Sean McCumber. At the close of Mr. Velas' case, Mr. Lyons moved for a directed verdict, which was denied. Ms. Lyons called no witnesses herself. The court issued its decision on the same day, holding for Mr. Velas, but the court did not give Mr. Velas precisely what he requested. The court said it was, quote, not making a decision to modify the parental responsibilities, nor to modify the allocation parenting agreement, but instead ordered that the children, quote, shall receive presently required school vaccinations. I want to start off by talking about what this case is not about on appeal. This case is not about whether or not vaccinations are a good idea in general. This is a hotly contested issue in our society today, as everyone knows. It's a contested issue with respect to whether minor children receive vaccinations, and there's some strong opinions on both sides. But this case is not about the legitimacy or the advisability of vaccinations. This case is really about, it arises in the post-decree context, where there is already an order that the parents will handle these kinds of issues jointly. The issue presented to this court is this. If the parents cannot agree on a health-related issue for their minor children, and one parent seeks court intervention, what should be that parent's burden? What should they have to prove to the trial court if that parent wants to put the trial court in a position where it can make an informed decision, where the parties can't agree on health-related decisions for their minor children? What does the law require of that petitioning party to show so that the trial court can step in and make the call for what's in the best interest of those minor children? So that's the issue. What is the petitioning party's at the trial level, petitioning party's burden? And was it met here? We contend that the burden was neither properly identified respectfully by the trial court, nor was it satisfied in this case.
Counsel, what is the mechanism for resolving that? Obviously, you said that they went to mediation. But after mediation, I've looked through the parenting agreement that was signed in December of 2017, and there doesn't seem to be a mechanism in place unless I'm missing something.
I think there is a mechanism, and the mechanism is set forth where they're first of all required to go to mediation, and then there's a provision that says that they can go to trial court and ask the trial court to resolve it if mediation is unsuccessful.
Which is what they did.
Yes, that's exactly what
they did. So you think that was appropriate?
I think it was appropriate that they went to mediation, and I think that it was appropriate that they only went to trial after the mediation failed.
And you contend that it was a petition to modify. The burden that you're talking about right now, if we're going to put a burden on the petitioner, how do we resolve these situations if it's not just a simple balancing test?
I want to respond to Your Honor's first point, Justice Heidel. And that was
Heddle.
I'm so sorry.
It's spelled that way.
Judge Heddle. So, Justice Heddle. So, the first thing I want to respond to is that Mr. Vallis actually, in his motion, which is in the record, actually requested modification of the allocation judgment. So that's the relief that he sought before the allocation judgment. And I think the court understood that. The court just ruled that it was not going to modify.
And can I ask this question? Just because the court says I'm not modifying, us as the reviewing court, don't we just look at what substantively happened? And whether, no matter what the judge calls it, we could call it whatever we want if we decide that it was a modification. True?
Justice Peterson, I think that's dead on. It's a question of law. What was the February 14 order? And I do think, actually, the court can't really resolve this issue unless it first figures that question out. What was this order? Was this order an order modifying the allocation judgment? Or was it, as I've also contended, and I think our position is, what this order was something in the nature of injunctive relief. But before I move on, Judge Heddle, I wanted to address the second half of your question. I think you had two prongs, and I apologize, I forgot the second prong.
If there was no mechanism, why would there be a burden any more than a preponderance to determine what's in the best interest of the child if the parents cannot make the decision between the two of them?
Because the law is, if you're filing a petition, so I think there's only two things this order could be. It's either an injunction or a petition to modify the allocation judgment. Because there was already an agreement and an order saying, you guys are going to figure out jointly, that is, the parties are going to figure out jointly, all matters relating to the children's health. So if you want that to be modified so that it says, but on this one issue, sole decision-making authority will rest with the petitioning parent, if you want to do that, the mechanism isn't set forth in the allocation judgment. The mechanism is set by law. The burden is placed on a person asking for a modification of the allocation judgment that they have to prove by preponderance of the evidence two things. One, that there was a substantial change of circumstances. And two, that the requested modification is in the best interest of the minor children. So that is actually set out in the law. The law actually sets that out pretty clearly. Now, if the court were to determine that the February 14 order did not modify the allocation agreement, which is, you'd basically be taking the trial court at its word there, because that's what the trial court said. If we were to take the trial court at its word and say, okay, this is not an order modifying the allocation judgment, what is it? And I think the answer is clear. I think the case is, and I cited in our brief, In Re A Minor, the case says you've got to look at the substance of the order like Justice Peterson said. What is it? What does it do? You know, how does this operate? An injunction, a lot of courts answer this question in the context of determining whether there's jurisdiction. It rises a lot when somebody appeals an injunction or an order that the parties call an injunction. And so there's a good body of jurisprudence that gives the court some guidance. And the standard is the court ordering somebody to do something, or is the court ordering somebody to refrain from doing something? And I think that the fairest interpretation of the February 14 order is that it is clearly both compelling two parties to do something and compelling one party or two parties to restrain from interfering, right? So this is not like a permissive order. This isn't one where, oh, you can do something. There was one case, for example, where in pre-decree situation, a party was given permission to take some of the marital assets and purchase a house for herself and her children. And the court said that's not an injunction. That's just allowing her to do something.
Counsel, in family law cases involving children, isn't most of the issues dealt with in orders all the time, every day in every family law court entered, you could be making this argument that they're all injunctions. Who's going to transport the children? Ordering them to take them to counseling. Ordering them to go to health care, These are all parts of allocation judgments all the time, and they've never been designated an injunction in that context. Most of a parenting order is, you could argue this, you could call them injunctions because they're ordering the parties to do certain things and not do certain other things. So what would make this any different than the hundreds or thousands of these that any family law judge has seen? It just deals with one issue of the many in that commonly arise in family law orders.
Because it's post-decree. It's true that in family law courts all the time, people come in and they ask for temporary relief. Okay, we can't decide who's going to pick up and take the kids to school. We're in the middle of trying to get divorced. We're going to ask at some point for the court to make a final determination on all these issues, which it does pursuant to its statutory authority. But in this circumstance, we have an allocation order. So there has been an allocation order entered, basically ordering the parties to jointly decide all issues. And the remedies that Justice Peterson decided, and it's totally true, all over the state, courts are issuing orders. They do so pursuant to 501A, 501A3. It's usually a request for temporary assistance. And for example, I think there's a provision that says other temporary relief, which is available. And remember, I just mentioned a case where I was talking about how a court ordered, and I'll give you the citation for this before I close, where a court basically said, you know, gave permission to a wife to take some money out of the marital estate and said, we'll figure this out later, whether or not you're going to get to keep all that or you're going to have to true it up, right? The court said, you know what, that wasn't an injunction because it was issued under the 501A3 standard, other temporary relief. Why isn't this that? Because this is not temporary. This is a final order, and you can't unring this bell. This is an order that the children shall receive vaccinations.
You're comparing marital property issue to an allocation issue. Those are apples and oranges.
What I mean to say is that there's already been an order about how these decisions should be decided. There is no...
That does not cover this situation.
You know, Your Honor, I think it does. And the reason I think it does is because they broadly said all health decisions. There's no way that the parties could say, okay, if we can't agree on whether the kids should get aspirin, we're gonna check that box. You can't put all those scenarios into an allocation judgment. But I do think the parties in the court said, look, if it's any kind of health decision whatsoever, here's how it's gonna be resolved, right? So I think it actually was covered in the allocation judgment. And by the way—
And isn't it true that up until the allocation judgment was entered, all the evidence is that the children were getting their vaccinations persistently? And that the stopping occurred after that. So if you're saying that the allocation judgment dictates what should happen, and you incorporate the pattern that had happened until it was entered, then wouldn't that dictate, if we're going to buy into your argument, that the allocation judgment there, we got to follow it. If they were doing one thing persistently all the way up until the judgment was entered, and it isn't quite the language, and you're saying, no, this has got to be what we follow, then wouldn't you follow the pattern that had been occurring before?
No. And let me explain. I would quibble with one thing that you said, and that was that they were getting all the vaccinations. The son, according to the evidence, only received two vaccinations. I'm a parent. Our kid got a lot more than two in the first year.
Well, it stopped, though. While they were still together, he got those vaccinations. It was after the separation, as I understand it, is when, and then he later just finds out when the school year starts, that the son has not been getting the consistent vaccination.
So this is relevant to the issue of whether or not Mr. Vallis proved a substantial change in circumstances. And the judge said, well, what about all those vaccinations that took place before the AJ? Those can't be considered by law. Under the statute, you can only consider events that occurred after the judgment in making a determination. And that's in the statute, directly in the statute. And the second thing is, one of the things when you make a contract or when you issue an order, you don't want people coming into court saying, hey, you know, I know that this is what the allocation judgment said, but what about these other agreements we had? What about those? These parties agreed, and the court ordered, that all prior agreements and understandings were superseded by whatever was set forth in the allocation judgment. And these parties knew how to identify something that was really important to them, as they did with the provision that the children absolutely must be raised in the Christian faith. They said, oh, we're going to jointly make all decisions relating to religion, but they put it in the allocation judgment. If it was important to them and vaccination was not as important to them as this issue, the children would be raised in the religious faith. And I see I only have a little bit of time, but I want to close with a bit of a thought exercise. It's a little unconventional, but one of my arguments is that it's in the best interest of the children. That Mr. Vallis did not prove that it was in the best interest of the children, and the court's finding was an error. I recognize that you can read a lot of cases, and before you run into a case where an appellate court overturns a best interest determination by a trial court, the standard is significant. But I ask you this much. If a friend, two people, who are a couple who divorced, were having a hard time agreeing whether to vaccinate their children, and they came to you personally and said, we can't decide, we want you to decide. In the unlikely circumstance that you said, okay, I'll do that, right? You would only do it if you thought you had a duty. You might say to them, hey, I thought you had an agreement that you were going to work this out. Do you mind if I finish my point?
Go ahead.
Justices.
Sure.
In the unlikely event that you said, okay, I'll do that, you would probably only do it if you said, well, don't you guys have an agreement that you'll figure everything out by yourself? They better have a good reason why they need you to do it. Let's say you agreed to do it. What information would you want? If you were asked to make that determination, my first thing is, well, give me the pediatrician's number. Before I say that this is okay, I want to know the children's health conditions. I want to know a little bit about the parents' health conditions. Have they ever had a reaction to a vaccine? I had a reaction to MMR. I tell my doctors for my children the same thing whenever it's time for my own children. You would want all that information, because without that information, there's no way you could figure out what's best for the children. And that's our essential point, that the court didn't have the information that it needed by law. And I just gave you that everyday real world example, because I think it really illustrates these legal principles and doctrines. I don't think anybody should make that determination for those two friends without knowing that health history, without knowing things that this court did not know. And I'm not going to make an inference about whether the kids, for example, have an allergy to eggs or anything like that. The rest of our arguments are put forth in our brief. I wish I had more time to chat with the court. Thank you for your time.
Joseph McDade?
I have a couple of questions that I wanted to ask Mr. Martin. Yes, I have a couple of questions that I wanted to ask you. It says in the briefs that Ms. Lyons had gotten a religious exemption TV? Is that the only one she got it for?
That was in our motion for reconsideration, and in the motion for reconsideration, the religious exemption was obtained by Ms. Lyons for both children.
Did she consult Mr. Vallis before she did that?
I do not know the answer to that, Your Honor. I'm sorry.
But is there any?
She did submit those to the school, Willow Creek Elementary, at some point in time, and Illinois law recognizes that if a parent signs one of those exemption forms, they are entitled to keep their child out of school.
Is that a health issue?
It is a health issue.
And wasn't Ms. Lyons required to talk to Mr. Vallis about it before she did it?
I do know that the parties have been engaging. So this issue was first raised in 2020, I think. And the parties went to mediation on the issue in 2020. Mr. Vallis filed his motion seeking relief from the court in 2021, right? And so what happened was, I think that there was a long period of time where the parties were still conferring about this. I must be candid, I'm not aware of whether or not Ms. Vallis sought Ms. Lyons sought Mr. Vallis' concurrence with that. But that's what we're here for. That's why we went to the court. That's why this issue was being adjudicated before the court. Both parties were seeking a resolution of this disagreement.
I want to clarify something, because we've drifted into this whole healthcare discussion, and I appreciate the question by Justice McDade. But you made very clear in your brief, this decision had nothing to do with healthcare. It was entirely about religion. That was in your brief. You took that position, correct?
Which brief, Your Honor?
Your brief.
There are so many briefs, so I certainly understand why it would get hard to track them all. I sometimes have a hard time tracking them all. But in our primary brief, our arguments are as follows: that Mr. Vallis didn't sustain his burden to show a substantial change of circumstances, didn't prove best interests. We also said that the court's order on a directed verdict was erroneous, and that the court improperly relied on evidence that the GAL had reviewed out-of-court magazines. There was nothing about the only thing being religious. This much I will say, Your Honor. At the trial level, definitely the only, Ms. Lyons didn't put on any witnesses. That was her decision. The directed verdict was denied, and I think probably to preserve, right, in order to preserve the objection on a directed verdict motion, so she didn't put
any witnesses. Wasn't it at the trial level that she made it clear her basis was religion, it had nothing to do with health care? Unless my memory is completely, I'm just making that up.
With that clarification, at the trial court level, Ms. Vallis only indicated the religious objection. And that the trial court found that. The trial court said, look, your only objection. So I think it's a finding.
So why are we even then, how are we to review any health care decision? If your client narrowed the issue specifically at the trial level, we can't then judge a side issue that wasn't even raised.
It's not a side issue, it is the issue. The question is not, is her religious objection valid? The question is, did he carry his burden to show a change of circumstances in best interest?
I agree with that.
That's the burden. And so I agree. If you read the record, you get the view that what the court was deciding is the validity of her religious objection. That when you read the record, that's not what it should have been. The issue should have been, did you carry your burden to show change of circumstances? Did you carry your burden to show best interest? That's our position.
Counsel, one last question from me. What is it that you're asking this court to do?
I'm asking this court to reverse the February 14 order because I think it was entered in error.
And where does that leave the parties?
I think that leaves the parties in a situation where Mr. Vallis, if he still wants vaccinations, can probably come back to the court if he can show evidence that shows a change in circumstances. Here are some examples. As opposed to this purported change of position, which I don't think was legally well-founded.
Counsel, I don't need you to give me examples. I just wanted to know what you were asking for. Any other questions?
Reversal or in the alternative we're hearing, Your Honor.
Justice McDade, any other questions?
Yeah, I do, but I think it's probably too involved at this point to ask.
I certainly have no objection.
I read the statute differently because the question of vaccination was not ever one that was anticipated by the parties. The children had been vaccinated, and it just was not anticipated. And it seems to me that the statute says that in that circumstance, what the trial court looks at is not a substantial change in circumstance, but rather looks at what's in the best interest of the children only, and that that's the issue that we have to decide.
My first response to that is, that's fine, because I still think that the determination, if you're reading, Your Honor, was correct, I still think the determination that it was in the best interest of the children was erroneous. But I actually don't think it's true that in this case you can conclude that the issues of vaccination was not anticipated by the parties in the allocation judgment. I don't think that, so first of all, if you could consider the facts prior to the allocation judgment, if you could, and I don't think you can, and the statute says that, you wouldn't come away with the conclusion that the fact that the son had two vaccinations means that they're okay with all vaccinations. Mr. Vallis should have presented evidence about, I think, well, they had two, and that was all that the doctor recommended. But that's not true, and if you know, children are required and recommended to have a lot more than two. So I don't actually think it's a fair inference, if you could consider it, and I don't think you can, that the son had two vaccinations at birth and that's it, means that they agreed on vaccination. But I also think that this issue about, well, was vaccination anticipated? The court actually sort of said, look, there's no vaccination is nowhere mentioned, and held that against my client. It could easily go the other way. It could easily have gone the other way. You could have easily said, it wasn't a big deal to them, and yes, they did anticipate it. They thought about the thing. It wasn't a big deal to them, as big enough of a deal as, for example, raising your child in the Christian faith.
Justice McDade, do you believe that your question's been answered?
Yes.
All right. Thank you. And thank you, counsel.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, the court. Appreciate your time.
Thank you, Mr. Vallis.
Can I clarify some issues? Not arguing the point, but...
Mr. Vallis, I'm not going to allow you to do that because you had waived argument before. I've been sitting here watching. I can tell exactly what objections you had to these statements that were made. We are confined to what's in the record, and we will scour the record to make sure that the facts that are in the record are the facts that we use to make our determination. So
there were just questions asked that he couldn't answer.
I understand that. You had an answer. I could tell by your head shaking that you had an answer to a question that counsel could not answer. Unfortunately, unlike the trial court, I don't have the discretion to allow for these arguments to go on, and we have several other arguments left this afternoon. So I appreciate that, the situation that you're in, and it would have been handled differently if I were in my former position, I can tell you that. But rest assured that we will go through the record to make sure that the questions that can be answered by will be answered by.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. We're going to take the case under advisement, and an opinion will be issued